back to the old technology. I can't find my other voice recorder, so we got this old one. Sorry.
We got backup, and I forgot to turn this thing.
Actually, I forgot to leave it out in the office. So turn your cell phones off. Thank you very much. Okay.
All right, so let's get started. Because we have a lot to do today. We always have a lot to do, right? You know that?
Yeah.
All the best
of time. On Thursday, it's exam number 4 on chapters 9 and 10 on bond calculations.
If we have time today, or even if we don't, I'll stick around. We can spend some time doing worksheet number 2. There's an answer key, commentary. Also, from chapter 6, constant perpetual and discounted cash flow models. You get to bring your formula sheets and the two present value tables, one paper notes, Scantron, calculator. Also, chapter 9, which is not really that hard, folks. Just doing looking some stuff up and a few other things is due on Thursday. Okay? All right. Also, we have seen the light. We're actually, it's amazing, isn't it? See, one stinker. One very volatile, very risky stock can make us look very sad. Other than that, we'd be sitting pretty. Any questions? Any comments? Any thoughts? Are you getting an education? Yeah, good. What? No? Well, what's education? That's a good question. That's a good. What is music? What is education? What is science? What is life? And one of the professors here has a website called whatislife.com. He's awesome. Lucas Bueller. Anybody take Bueller? Over in Bueller. Lucas Bueller, not Bueller, you know.
I was about to say.
No, he's really good. If you take any classes with him.
I'm sorry, the
9, 10, 18. Just a few little questions on preferred. No calculations from preferred stocks and convertibles. No calculations on those. But just a few questions. If you were remotely sober before we left Thursday, when we talked about preferred and convertible securities, preferred stock and convertible securities, you will do well on those 3 or 4 questions. There's just a few questions on that. Okay. Now, I tell this little story because I'm always afraid that I'm doing the same thing to some people because you're always confusing somebody. But in my undergraduate years, I was a math major, and we had this one professor, brilliant guy. I mean, the guy was really sharp, but nobody knew what the hell was going on. And at near the end of the semester, he said, okay, now we're going to have this lecture. It's going to tie everything together, and hopefully, I know some of you are confused, but hopefully it's going to all make sense now. And we're really excited. And afterwards, we're looking at each other. Do you want me to tell myself? He's talking to us. So I hope I don't wind up doing that. But we're going to do that. We're going to now tie everything we've learned together about stocks, bonds, mutual funds, short-term investments, and throw it into this one presentation called Diversification and Risky Asset Allocation. But first, we need a good joke. Anybody got a good joke? No? You want a groaner?
Sure.
Groaner? Okay. So these two cows are out in the field. Did I tell you about this before? The two cows on the field. It's a beautiful sunny day, and they're chewing the cud, right? And the one cow says to the one cow, you know, I was artificially inseminated this morning. And the other cow says, ah, I don't believe that. The first cow says, it's true. No bull. No bull. They come afterwards. Okay. Diverse. No bull. No Taurus. No Taurus. I'll tell you afterwards. Okay. Diversification. Spreading your investment assets across a number of asset classes to eliminate some, but not all, of the risks of investing. You've heard the saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Have you heard that saying? That's the idea, right? And then there's a saying that's attributed to Mark Twain. He probably didn't say it, but it's a cute saying. Put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket. I don't know if I agree, but it's a cute little saying. Watch it crash and burn. Diversification, folks, has been one of the best methods to reduce risk. So what are we looking at? It might be a little difficult That Carotta, would you dim the lights? Maybe it'll be easier to see. Going back from 1987 to 2011, what we find is if we break the investing universe into several parts, U.S. large companies, Standard & Poor's 500, global small cap companies, international, or EAFE, emerging markets, U.S. bonds, international bonds, we find that no one category is always going to be the best. If we see any one category that's been the best over the 25 years, which one is it?
Emerging markets.
Emerging, but he's up in the front. He can see. Emerging markets. But sometimes there are submerging markets, right? They have exhibited far more volatility. So if we've been able to just hold on, we did really, really well in the last 25 years, but we had stomach aches the whole time we were doing it. And notice, not one time, not one time was cash ever the highest one. You'll hear people say, are you in cash? Are you in the market? No, I got all my money in cash. Why? Because I'm afraid the market's going to fall. I'm waiting for a drop. Oh, well, good luck. Not even 2008. Well, when they say U.S. bonds did better, that's because treasuries did really better. So if you're in cash in 2008 or treasury bonds, other bonds fell. So what is the lesson? What do you want to do?
Diversify.
Exactly. Do you want to be in cash for the long term?
No.
You got to deal with the volatility. Now, maybe if you want to be a market timer on the margin, you know, take 20% or so, hold it in cash, wait for, be a contrarian, wait for it to fall, but it hasn't worked for me, and I haven't tried it, but I kind of knew that things were going to fall in 2008, but I waited. I kept doing what I normally do, putting my money in every month into the Roth and into the 403B. And then when it crashed a little bit in 2008 in October, I put my money into my SEP IRA, only to have it crash another 30%. So, you know, I didn't do a very good job either. How do we measure risk? How do you get back to measuring risk? We have come full circle. Way back in Chapter 1, we introduced the tug of war between risk and return. Risk versus return. We saw how higher the average annual return, the higher the standard deviation. And it's a companion measure variance from the average annual return. Remember standard deviation? How far away are you from the average? We have studied the major financial asset classes, mutual funds, stocks, bonds, and cash. We discussed the risks and returns of each. Return is easy to measure. How much money did you make? How long did it take you to make that money? Boom, there's your return. But risk is very difficult to measure. It's even harder to anticipate. Standard deviation is not a good measure of risk, folks. It just means that your investment's going to be volatile. And if you're in it for the long term and can stomach the volatility, obviously emerging markets were the better deal for you. But if you're going to run for the hills when the market drops 20, 30, 40%, then you know, that's not a good investment. Variance and standard deviation. Variance and its more useful companion, standard deviation, tell us how much an asset class will vary from the expected return. These measures are readily available from the investment community, and the numbers ain't pretty. For any randomly selected stock on the New York Stock Exchange, the standard deviation is almost 50%. These randomly selected stocks. And these are, you know, traditionally the most stable stocks. That means in any one year, many stocks on the New York Stock Exchange will vary up or down close to 50% from their average annual return. So how can we reduce the risk? In other words, how do we reduce the variance? How do we reduce the risk? The answer, of course, is to diversify. If we go from one randomly selected stock to two randomly selected stocks, the standard deviation goes down from 50 to about 37%. If we do 10, near 24. 20, 21 and a half, and so on. Diversifying our stock portfolio reduces our risk substantially, as measured by the reduced variance and standard deviation, which we've already figured out is not a perfect way to measure risk. So here's the table from your book that shows as you add the stocks to your portfolio, you see the standard deviation going down. And this is a percentage of the one randomly selected stock. So we see the standard deviation going down. We see the percentage going down. But then what happens once we get to 100, 200, 300? What's going on here? Our ability to reduce our risk becomes limited. In fact, that's the word you use in math. It's called a limit. Do you remember that? The asymptotes and the limits and all that stuff from math?
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, right. The limit. There is a limit to which diversification can reduce your risk in any given asset class. In this case, stocks or bonds, whatever. Why is that? Because of a one word called correlation. So you understand this graph? You see what's happening? As we add more stocks, we don't really get any lower risk as measured by standard deviation. Correlation, and I want you to remember this, but more important, it makes sense. It just makes us intuitively know this. We say, how's the market doing? Even though the market is thousands of stocks. It's the tendency of the returns of two assets to move together. Imperfect correlation is the key reason why diversification reduces portfolio risk as measured by the portfolio standard deviation. Because no two investment returns will be perfectly the same, will be exactly the same. If an investment is positively correlated, that means it'll tend to move together. If two investments or 10 investments or whatever. If they're negatively correlated, they're going to move in opposite directions. And so here, is this making sense? Okay, good. And here is the correlation coefficient. They usually, mathematicians usually use R, uppercase or lowercase R. The correlation coefficient tells us how well correlated or how well uncorrelated the 2 or 10 or whatever investments are. Negative 1 means that they're completely out of sync. One goes up, the other one goes down. That's negative 100%. Positive 1 is they are perfectly correlated. They go up and down together. And then 0 means that they don't have no correlation whatsoever. So here's the graph. Sorry. One too fast. So you understand? If it's 100% correlation, the two of them, or 10 of them, or whatever they are, will go in sync with one another. If it's negative 100%, negative 1, and you usually don't see it as a percent, you'll see it from negative 1 to 1, but it's the same idea. If it's negative 1, that means they go in opposite direction. If it's 0, then they just do their own thing and have nothing to do with one another. So here are three graphs, and they're not particularly great, but they're from your book. Here are two investments that are perfectly correlated. Now, one goes higher and lower. One has more deviation. One is more volatile. But they both work in the same direction. Here are two that are absolutely out of sync with one another, so to speak. They have perfect negative correlation. They are completely out of sync. One goes up, the other one goes down. And that one comes back up, and that one goes down. And then this graph, I don't think is actually that good, because it actually does look like there's some correlation there. But what they're trying to show you is that two of them have nothing to do with one another. They're completely out of sync. One goes up, the other one goes sideways, and then the other one goes down, and then goes up. It does. They're totally uncorrelated. So how does this answer our question about why diversification can only reduce by so much the risks of owning stocks? Well, intuitively we know why. although stocks are not perfectly correlated, you know, there's no two stocks that are going to do exactly the same thing. They are imperfectly correlated. They are positively correlated enough so that stocks in general tend to move in the same direction. This is why we often refer to stock investments as a whole as the stock market. How's the market doing today? Even though at any given time, some companies are doing great, others are doing poorly, and many are simply chugging along as they always have done. Does it make sense? Yeah, or am I good? Okay, good. Darn! This is still too much risk for me. I think I'm going to stick to bonds. And, you know, you can't know how people feel unless they tell you. But hopefully, as you've gone along, you've felt these feelings like, oh, no, this sounds too risky for me. Or, no, I'm excited, I'm ready. But you'll see some people are just, I stay away from the stock market. I'm going to stick with bonds. You're a very conservative, risk-averse investor, and you don't like the volatility of stocks. You don't like seeing your $1,000 go to $6,000, your $10,000 go to $6,000. I'm sorry, your $1,000 go to, you like $2,000 going to $6,000, your $1,000 going to $600, your $10,000 going to $6,000, your $100,000 going to $60,000. So you decide to place all your investments into bonds. You will accept the lower return from the bonds in exchange for the lower risk of the bonds. Oops. Bad idea. Why? Because like stocks, bonds are positively correlated with themselves.
You're not like a protection thing to you.
Well, you're going to get less risk, but not as much as you thought.
Oh.
Because what happens with bonds? Interest rates go down, bond prices go up. Interest rates go up, bond prices go down. So bonds tend to be correlated with themselves. And they tend to be negatively correlated with stocks. Because when interest rates go up, that's usually, but not always, a sign that the economy is doing well. If the economy does well, how do stocks do? Great! So while stocks are booming, bonds might be failing. Or maybe just staying not the same. And when interest rates go down, that's often the case where we're in a recession. What happens to stocks in a recession? They get hammered. And interest rates going down is usually great. I mean, that means bond prices are going to go up. So bonds and stocks not always are negatively correlated. Stocks tend to do well when bonds don't do well, and vice versa. So here's a graph. I don't know if it makes any sense, but let's see. Here's the standard deviation on the bottom axis. Here is axis. And here's the expected return on the y-axis. And what happens? If we have 100% stocks, history tells us we're going to get the best return. We're also going to have the most risk. We're going to, as measured by standard deviation. As we start to reduce our exposure to stocks and increase the exposure to bonds, the risk starts falling, but also does the return. That's what we expect. But we get to a point where we start turning the corner. The graph turns. And sure, the return keeps going down, but now the standard deviation goes up because bonds are correlated with themselves. You make sense? Yeah? No? No, it just means we're getting less return. We're getting 6%, plus we're getting more volatility. Which means we're getting more risk as measured by volatility, as measured by standard deviation. It's better if we blend the two, if we're really worried about the standard deviation. If not, especially if you're young, I think you should be here and just deal with the volatility. And if you don't panic, it's going to be in your favor, because what's going to happen when the market falls? You get to get more shares at a lower price. It's a good time for you. But, you know, emotions are the investor's worst enemy, as Benjamin Graham said. So here's the graph in table form, and see if this makes more sense. I'm sorry? You're absolutely right. He's got it on the nose. He's got it on the nose. People hate to lose money. Right? They just hate it. And who doesn't? Do you like losing money?
I mean, it's a cycle.
And you can be intellectually prepared, but does that mean you're going to be emotionally prepared?
Oh, no.
And I've seen very, very smart people, folks. Very smart people make the absolute worst decisions with regards to finance. They might be brilliant geniuses with regards to whatever their, you know, whatever their expertise is. But when it comes to finance, it's a rookie mistake. But it's emotions that rule us often more than our mind, right? And so here's the same graph, but in table form. As we reduce our stock exposure, and you can think of these as 100%, and we increase our bond exposure, our return keeps going down and down and down and down and down. And 6% for 100% bond portfolio is not what we're getting right now, folks. Bonds are not paying 6%, but that's what they typically pay over the long term. And we see our standard deviation going down until there's an inflection point, is what they call it in math, and it starts turning around and going back up. Now, there are some studies that show that this is not really the case, that bonds are not as risky as they say here in this study. But it's still, the idea is you want to blend. My personal opinion, if you're not going to go completely with stocks, then a combination of stocks and bonds actually created a portfolio with less risk while earning you more return than just bonds. So if you're seeking less risk, it not only pays to diversify within an asset class, it pays to diversify among asset classes. The same kind of relationship occurs with domestic and foreign stocks and bonds, because the United States has a different cycle than the rest of the world, but more, less and less that's happening. It turns out that the developing world was so amazing. You know, normally when a financial catastrophe of the size that happened in 2008 and 2009 would hit the West, because it did hit Europe somewhat, actually a lot, and it hit us, the rest of the world, the emerging markets, Mexico and the like, would go on life support. In something that never happened before, the emerging markets actually were doing well, because they had their debacle back in the late 90s, and they kept their balance sheets clean and not over borrowed. And now what's happening is it's turning. The emerging markets are now having some turbulence. Some people think it's just temporary, but China's kind of, you know, and Brazil and India are kind of, and Russia is just bugs. Okay, so diversification, though, is still not a guarantee of positive return results. In 2008, unless you thought your idea of diversification was treasury bonds and cash, you fell down. And a lot of you are going to eventually buy a condo or a home, so you're also going to have some real estate. Make sense? And real estate we'll discuss later on at the end of the semester. We'll spend a little bit of time. We've got some experts here in real estate, and so hopefully we'll have some, chiming in. Real estate is a royal pain in the thing. Okay, I'm sorry?
A little bit off topic, but no, the real estate, that guy, I don't understand, I'll see that Armando or something, is he legit?
I don't know. Who is
he?
Is he telling you can buy a free bedroom for $19,000? Oh, I passed it around, yeah. If he's trying to tell you can buy a three bedroom, you can.
No.
In Detroit.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe like $100,000 or
something. With no money down.
Yeah.
Right.
No, but he just passed around a flyer that he came to San Diego.
Yeah, sure. I thought it was Vanilla Ice.
Still, if it sounds too good to be true. Okay. We have a name for choosing the appropriate mix for an investor. It is called asset allocation. And if you remember, we saw some mutual funds that said asset allocation funds, right? Yeah, and we saw some that said balance. All things being equal, I'd prefer balance, but you have to look at each mutual fund. It's a fancy term for how much should I have in stocks, how much should I have in bonds, how much of each stock, how much of each bond type. Many investors for decades suggested a formula like this. You take 100 and then you subtract your age. So let's say it's and that's how much should be in stocks, right? That's how much should be in stocks. So if we have 40, if we have, I'm starting to translate perfectly into Spanish, if we have 40 years. If we are 40 years old, because they use tener, they use have. If we are 40 years old, then we should be 60% in stocks and 40% in bonds. And some people say we should, whatever our age is, should be our bond percentage. Okay, but what you'll notice is that this number is rising, 110, 120. Why? Because people are living longer. What, if you think about it, 60 years, 65 years old, that was a ripe old age 100 years ago or 70 years ago. So if you were 60 years old, even though they didn't expect you to live that much longer, you still should have been 40% in stocks and 60% in bonds. But now 60 is considered young. Yeah, 70, 80, 90. Ah, 90, that's when you start getting old. So, do the in the 121 class, we have, it's on the website, we have that longevity game. They ask you certain questions and they say, you know, you're going to live to 87, you're going to live to 94. See, it's a cute. Well, that's the problem. You don't know when.
I'm just saying, like, if I'm like 80, I'm like, I already know.
Well, it's about time to start spending it. Yeah. I have one client.
No, I mean, like, if I'm young, I want to, like, make money. But if I'm old, I'm like, I'm going to spend it all.
I agree with you. And it's sometimes hard to convince the elderly to start spending their money. Why? Because they're children of the Depression. What, the kids?
Yeah, they're going to fight over.
Right, the little monsters. Don't leave it around for them.
Yeah, like,
what? Write it down when you get back to bed. Okay, now, there are others, and I'm in this camp, who say, poppycock! Don't do it! I mean, think about it. Somebody at 20, they shouldn't have any bonds, in my humble opinion. Buy high-quality stocks, put up with the risk. Once you're near retirement, start buying bonds. Here's an example. And if you like it, use it, right? You are a little worried about the stock market volatility, and you got $100,000 that you inherited from your granddad Trudy. So you're going to put 25% in bonds, 75% in stocks. Of the bonds, we'll have $15,000 in high-grade corporate government investment grade, right? BBB or above. 5,000, 5% in junk, in high yield, high income distressed, speculative bonds, and 5% global. Of the 75,000, 75% stocks, notice that 50%, 25 and 25, I have in growth and income. That's me. I think it actually should be more, especially if you're younger. 10% in aggressive growth, 10% international, 5% small company stocks. What do you think? You like it?
Yeah.
You can have it. It's yours. Now, in reality, if you were in your 20s, I would not recommend any bonds. But that's just me. And you have to get a feel for what the individual investor, what their feelings about risk are, especially if they haven't never put a dime away. If they get this huge chunk all of a sudden and they see it go down to 90,000 or 80,000 before it starts going back up again, how are they going to react? You don't know until it happens. The best people are the ones who say, oh, I don't even look at it. I signed up for email delivery and I delete the emails. Good idea. Okay, rebalancing. How are we doing? Making sense? Is it tying it together, folks? Is it making sense? And you see why it makes a really good, it makes a good argument, a good case for a balanced fund, especially for people who are worried, because the balanced fund usually stays about 60-40,
60% stocks, 40% bonds, maybe a little bit more stocks, bonds, and then 50-50. Balanced funds are good for people who are worried. Some of these same advisors that suggest asset allocation also suggest a technique known as rebalancing. Every year, check to see if your percentages are still in balance. If stocks have had a banner year, you might now be 70-30. Stocks have done well. Bonds have sort of languished or maybe went down. So now you have 70% stocks, 30% bonds. Every year, it's time to rebalance. You sell enough of your stocks so that you're back to 60%. You buy enough bonds so that you're back up to 40%. Now, this is cool because it forces you to do the right thing. Stocks are doing well. Do you want to sell? No. It feels good to watch that account go up. Bonds have done poorly. Do you want to buy? Yes, good. Well, most of them, no. Bonds are stinky. So it forces you to do the right thing. It forces you to buy low, sell high. Is it a guarantee of success? Everyone wants to say no. Is it a guarantee? Is it a guarantee of success? No. Right, exactly. Now, what about in retirement? Many advisors suggest that retirees shed the bulk of their stock investments in favor of bonds and cash investments. More and more they're not doing this. They realize that people are living longer. The only problem is people are living much, much longer. The statistic that I read is that 50-year-old today, turning 50, has a 50-50 chance of living to see 100 years old.
That's a long time.
Yeah, and, well, that's what you say now, right? That's what you say now. But you millennials should easily make it to 100.
No, the way people need to be real
good. Okay, thank you. There are caveats. There are caveats. How well are you taking care of yourself? Are you still drinking that fizzy sugar water with the brown crayon stuck in it? Are you eating lots of meat? It turns out that meat was great when we lived 30 years. It was good food for us. Okay. Now when we live 100 years, 120, supposedly the first person to live 150 years has already been born. That's what you read or said. Okay. So we won't know, of course, because, you know, that's the future. But I like to think of it like cars. What? I forget what it was. It was something I read a little while ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. But I like to think of it as cars. You know, 60 years ago, if you had a car that made it to 100,000 miles, that was pretty amazing. They just didn't live. They didn't survive that. The cars just did not survive that. But now, if you don't make it to 100,000 miles... Yeah, because that you obviously didn't do something, or maybe just there was something really... But yeah, it usually can be fixed. I mean, the cars, forget the drivetrain and the engine and everything. The car just dissolved. The rust, it just dissolved in front of your eyes. So as you near retirement, start migrating your investments from stocks to bonds, but don't abandon stocks entirely, in my humble opinion. So now let's take a few moments.
How can you keep your bond if you're retiring?
Well, the idea is in retirement you need income from your investments.
Yes.
And what do bonds pay? Interest. So you're basically living off the interest from your bonds.
And then would you just pass your bond down if you were to pass away?
Well,
until it matures?
Until it matures, right, and then you get your money back. In other words, how much do you want to leave to your ingrateful kids? You know, how much will you leave to your lovely little children? Well, it depends. Some bonds mature early, some bonds mature later. But most of us, how are we going to buy bonds? Through mutual funds. So the mutual fund takes care of what happens when it retires. Yes?
Some people just like retire off, living off their dividends.
Sure. Sure. If you have built a portfolio of high-quality dividend-paying stocks, maybe if you've been using, remember the DRIPs, the dividend reinvestment plans? Then you're getting, right now, about the same of what bonds are paying. 3%, maybe 4%. And, of course, if you bought them at a lower price, you're getting more of a percentage. But still, given the price that they are, you're getting maybe 3% from bond, from your dividends, from your stocks. Well, what are bonds paying? A little bit more, 3.5%, 4%. I like bonds when they're paying 6%. That's, you know, my personal opinion. So sure, and many retirees are. They're looking at dividends paying stocks as a form of income. Because right now, getting good yield is not an easy thing to do from bonds. In fact, that's part of your Chapter 9 assignment. What are they paying? What are treasuries paying? What are corporates paying? What are unis paying? Look at the spread. And they're not paying very much. Interest rates are very low, so bond prices are high. What's going to happen when interest rates go up? Bonds are going to go down. Now, are interest rates going to spike up? I don't think so. It doesn't mean I'm right. But I think if a lot of people who bought bond mutual funds with the thought, oh, I don't have to live through 2008 again, it's not going to go down 50-60%, I think they're right, it's not going to go down that much. But they might, well, last year they saw a 2% decline in general, you know, some more, some less. Did I answer your question? Okay, good. Okay, so here let's take a look at some portfolio illustrations. Here we go. So what happens? Your financial advisor, or you decide, you're in retirement, you're going to stick with bonds. So here's a bond fund, a portfolio of bonds that is managed on your behalf. This is called an illustration. I showed you these in Chapter 4. This is stuff that you have to read that says, be afraid, be very afraid. Figures shown are past results and are not predictive of results in future periods. Current and future results may be lower or higher than those shown. Share prices and returns will vary, so investors may lose money. You think anybody reads this stuff? No, but it's got to be there legally to tell you, yes, you can lose money. And so all the crap that nobody reads, here's the part they want to look at. So we've been investing for however many years, and we got a nest egg of $200,000. Now, you're going to do better than that, I know. Because you're going to start early, you're going to be mostly invested in stocks, and I know you're going to do well. But still, not a shabby amount, right? And how do we take this money out now, as Will said? I want to blow it off, right? Well, not a good idea. See, if you knew what day you were going to die, oh, wouldn't that be great? Get a bunch of credit cards, run them off, but that's the problem, you don't know. So we started in 1994 with $200,000, and what we're going to do is we're going to start taking out 4% every year. That's one of the magic numbers that you'll hear people say. You're going to take out 4% or 5%. 6, some people say take out 6, that's a little on the high side, I think. But if you start taking out 4% and then every year increase it, that's the amount you took out, not from 4 to 7 to 9 to 10%, but increase that by 3%. So we start taking out 4% of our portfolio, and then next year recalculate that, but take out an extra 3% of the amount we took out. So we see that our withdrawals are growing, right? Our withdrawals are growing, assuming our total value is growing, because we're expecting to get 5-6% from our bonds, aren't we? So we're going to see our portfolio grow unless bonds have a down year, and then we will see our income grow. And what happens is we wind up taking out $240,000 out of our nest egg, and we still have close to what the nest egg started with. The cumulative dividend income?
Yeah.
Well, that's being the mutual funds, unless you say otherwise, are going to turn around and reinvest the dividend and capital gains. Notice there's only 1 year of capital gains. You don't get capital gains that often with bonds. You're reinvesting it back into the mutual fund. Our withdrawal, we could set our withdrawals to be the dividend income. We could set it up. But what we did is we set up our withdrawals to be 4% of the initial portfolio, $200,000. And 4% of $200,000 is what? $8,000 a year? $8,000 a year, and then we increased it every year by 3%. Not, I'm not talking about 4 to 7 to 10 to 13% of the portfolio. I'm saying whatever we took out that year, 4%, whatever that was, next year, increase that amount by 3%. And
4.3%.
Yeah, I think it's 4.3%. But it's not, it doesn't really work out perfectly. But that's the idea. And so what's happening is we see our withdrawals going up because inflation's going up, assuming our total value goes up, assuming we get 5, 6%. Make sense? And so would you be happy with that, 5.84%? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Watch what happens if we then say, well, we're going to stick with bonds. Stocks, I'm sorry. Where did it go? Here are we. Let's go to stocks. And this is a typical stock mutual fund. And here's the scary part. Be afraid. Be very afraid. The stuff that nobody reads. And we're starting off with 200,000. And now what's happened? Well, we're starting again with 4% and going up 3% every year. So our withdrawals are much higher. Why? Because look what's happening to our account value. The late 1990s were pretty good years for stocks. But then we had 2000, 2001, 2002, and what happened? We saw our withdrawals rising, and then, because the portfolio, we readjust for the portfolio amount going down from 468 down to 345, and you're in retirement. Are you going to stay in stocks? Are you going to stay with the horse that got you there? You know, and maybe not. Maybe you're ready to bail. But if you stick around, hey, we're back in the money through the 2000s, and our withdrawals are going up. But then 2008 happens from 478 to 3293. Ouch. Yeah, right? And then our income drops precipitously, but we stuck with it, and sure enough, we lived through the volatility. We had not quite, but almost twice as much withdrawals, plus our nest egg is 2.5 times more. Two and a quarter times more. Are you with me? We didn't show you the graph the last time, but look at the graph here. Uh-oh, what did I do? Go away. I don't know how I did this. Cancel. Go away. I don't know how I did this, but I don't know how to get rid of it. We didn't show you the graph in the last one, but look at the graph here. We did pretty darn well. We looked like geniuses, and then, our stomachs went, and then back again, and then, Okay, so let's say we don't want to do that. Let's say we go with stocks and bonds. We go with a balanced fund. There's the scary part. Be afraid. Be very afraid. And now, what we're going to see is we got, what, 10? I keep forgetting. Did we get over 10%? I'm sorry. Let's go take a look. What? 11. Yeah, we did pretty darn well. I mean, 11%. This is a particularly good stock fund. But here's a balanced fund. And we're going to do the exact same thing. 4% go up. And what we're going to see is that we don't make as much money, but we make a whole lot more than just bonds. And we know our nest egg nowhere near as high as it was with stocks, but it's a lot more than with bonds. And we get almost 9%, particularly good balance fund. But look at the graph. Is it as 2008 was a blast from the sky. But you see what happens when we balance, especially in retirement. We smooth out the volatility, and we do a whole lot better than if we just stay with bonds. That's the money. Questions, thoughts, ideas, comments, criticisms, suggestions? You guys are tired? Okay. Having a balanced portfolio means that you almost never have the best returns in any one year. Look what happens. Stocks almost always, you know, not always, about two-thirds of the time or more, do better than bonds. And in just one year out of the last 20-some-odd years, 25 years, the blend did better than either one together. So if you have a balanced portfolio, you almost never have the best returns in any one year. However, it also means that you will very rarely have the worst returns in any one year either. Never is the balance, or is there one time the balance is the worst? I don't think. There's never a time when the balance is the worst return. So, in addition, although it is very unlikely that you will not equal or surpass an all-stock portfolio over time, you should do much better than an all-bond portfolio, which you already know we're going to add, right? What am I going to add?
No guarantees.
Everybody should say no guarantees.
No guarantees.
No guarantees. Okay, cool. Excellent. Now, we are here at Southwestern, and I'm very proud that we're here at Southwestern, but do any of you have trust funds that you're going to inherit from granduncle Lucas? Maybe? Good for you. Well, most of us are working class grunts who are going to work our way into the benevolent machine and trade our paycheck for our mortgage or rent and our, you got it, their life for a paycheck. And this is how most of us are going to invest, I think. If anybody is going to inherit $1.2 million, you know, come talk to me. I'll be, do what I can help do to help you. But most of us are going to be putting $50, $100 a month into our mutual fund. And what we love is dollar cost averaging, a system of buying an investment at regular intervals with fixed dollar amounts. Now, this slide should look familiar because this is what we did back in Chapter 4. We talked about mutual funds. With dollar cost averaging, there is always good news. The market's up. Good news. Right. It's fun to watch your account go up in value. The market's down. Good news. Right. Next month, you're going to get more shares at a lower price when the $50 or $100 comes out of your paycheck or your checking account. Here is an example. And I know you're not going to memorize this, but I hope you do. Your average cost per share should be less than your average price per share. It's not a guarantee. Here's one investment that you made, and you put $1,000 every year into this investment. And so here's 2007, here's 2008, here's 2009. Okay? That's basically what happened. In 2007, you put $1,000, the share price of your mutual fund or your stock was $10, and you purchased 100 shares. So you now have 100 shares, right? Next year, it drops 50%. 2008 comes along. You put the $1,000 into the mutual fund, and at $5 a share, you get 200 shares. So your cumulative total shares are 300. Now the investment recovers. It goes up 50%. Well, 2009 it went up 30%, so it's not quite perfectly. But it goes up to 750. Now you buy 133.33333 shares. So you have 433 shares, 0.333. Just looking at the price, the average price is $7.50. It looks as you should have broken even, right? Because you bought some shares at $10, some shares at $5, some shares at $7.50. Your average cost per share, though, was $6.92. Because you bought fewer shares when it was higher, more shares when it was lower. But the average price per share is $7.50. So although it looks as though you should have simply broken even, you actually made money because you bought more shares at the lower prices. The value of the shares is $3,250. You put in $3,000, but you actually made money because of dollar cost averaging. Do you understand? It is not a guarantee. Dollar cost averaging is not a guarantee for a good result. If the price kept going down and down and down and down, is it going to turn a bad investment into a profit? No, not unless it starts coming back up again. But it makes it very simple for those of us working grunts who trade our life for our paycheck, and the $100 goes into the Roth IRA or into the 401k, and maybe they match $50. By always investing the same amount of money, you are purchasing more shares when the price is low, fewer shares when the price is high. That's why you millennials would love to see a crash. Not really, because that means people are out of work and everything. But so here it is. memorize this line. I know it's hard to remember, but your average cost per share should be lower than your average price per share. Although, as I've already said, it is not a guarantee of success. Dollar cost averaging is not going to help a lousy investment turn a handsome profit. But it does make investing very, very easy. For mutual fund investors, that is. It's a bit trickier with stocks. It's a bit trickier with bonds. Because you're going to buy $50 worth of one stock? Maybe you could buy one share, but you're going to pay $12 for the commission. What people often do, if you want to invest in individual stocks and you only got $50 a month, is you put $50 into your savings account or into the brokerage firm, and then wait until it gets up to $600 or $700 or $1,000, and then buy 12 shares or 24 shares of the stock, because you still have to pay that $10, $12 commission. Are you with me? Make sense? Okay, good. And bonds, they only want to talk to you until they get $25,000. Speaking of mutual funds, wasn't diversification one of the two main reasons why so many investors choose mutual funds?
Yeah.
Yes. Look what happened to us. We picked 9 good stocks, 1 stinker. Ooh. But does that mean mutual funds necessarily have less risk than individual portfolios or the market? Yeah, maybe. Right, exactly. It depends on which mutual funds we're talking about. So go to Morningstar, go to finance.yahoo.com, enter a mutual fund such as Dodge & Cox or Washington Mutual, and find the link to risk. And that's your assignment for Chapter 11. Because we spend a whole lot of time talking about how well they do over the long term, what's the return, we don't spend as much time looking at the risk. And how do you measure risk? Well, there are a few measurements that we discuss on the handout that I gave you. Standard deviation, certainly, alpha, beta, a few other strange ones. But the one that now you don't have to pay for, you go to the library, you could have gone to the library and gotten it for decades, but the one that they're now showing for free is the upside-downside ratio. Very cool. How much of the upside of the market does the mutual fund capture, and how much of the downside does it capture? Think about it. If we have time, we'll look at it if you want to. Okay, so here is an example of what, I don't know if you can see this graph that easily, but what many market historians have observed is the tendency of mutual fund inflows and outflows to be a fairly reliable contrarian indicator of market performance. In other words, when inflows into stock mutual funds go really, really high, that's been a great time to sell. And when outflows go really, really, really high, I mean, people are pulling their money out, that's been the best time to buy. And same thing with bonds. In 1994, the bond market went down. Interest rates started coming up as we got out of the 1991-92 recession. That makes sense. Interest rates going up, it's a good sign. What happened to bonds? They went down. So what do people do? They pulled their money out of bond funds at the worst possible time. The stock market started exploding in the 1990s. In 2000, people dumped over $300 billion into net inflows, they're called, into the stock market. That was the worst possible time to invest in the stock market because the next 3 years the stock market did pitifully, and look what happened. At the worst possible time, they finally capitulated after a 50% downturn in 2002, that we had positive outflows out of stock mutual funds. And sure enough, the market then, we did pretty well over 2003 to 2007. And then sure enough, in 2008, what did people do? 2008, 9, 10, and 11, people took more money out of stock mutual funds than they put in. As the market plummeted, and as it came back 100%. So what's the best thing to do? The exact opposite of what other people are doing. You see everybody doing this thing, you should do the other thing. But are most of us going to be contrarian investors? No, I think most of us are going to be buying, that's what I am, buy and hold, put in the money. If I see, something, I try to put in more, but mostly I just put in whatever comes out of my paycheck, goes into my 403B, goes into my Roth. Questions, thoughts, ideas? Okay, and that is our Chapter 11. Did you like that one?
Oh, thank you.
Did it tie it all together?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good, because we're done.
We're done.
No, I'm not. I'm serious. I am serious. All the information you need for stocks, bonds, mutual funds, we are done.
Now.
Hang on a minute. Okay.
Now.
Okay. Right. Right. We're going to have our exam on Thursday for bonds, and when we come back next week, we start items that you need to know, but hopefully you will never touch with a 10-foot pole. And that options, futures, shorting, margining, these are things that you need to understand, you need to be aware of, and if you take the Series 7, you got to know them inside out. But hopefully you will never touch them with a 39.5-foot pole, as Dr. Seuss says.
Have you ever touched
one? No, I never have.
Have you ever done margining?
No, not margining. No, wait a minute. I did do some margining. That was true. I did do some margining, but I quickly gave up on that. It's just a long story, because I wanted to buy Philip Morris so bad. It was paying 12%. And my wife said, "Don't you dare buy Philip Morris." So I kind of did with my margin. What?
But she doesn't know.
That's true. Anyway. Okay. So when we come back and start next week, which will be week 14, we're week 13 already. We will start discussing things that I hope you never touch. Margining is actually not bad once you've built up a portfolio. There are times when you could do margining, but for the most part, stay away from it. And then we will spend a little bit of time discussing real estate, gold, precious metals, collectibles, because they're a tiny little piece of the investment universe. For some people, that's their life, but for most of us, no. And that'll be the end of the semester. So now, what we can do now, for those of you who want to, is we can go over the worksheet number 2 for bond calculations.
Are they
going to
be on the exam?
They're going to be on the exam. Yes.
What's the
zero bond?
Do you go over that?
Okay, that one you got to put your thinking took on. What? Okay, number. She's asking about number 9. Let's take a look at it on the screen. Those of you who want to disappear, go right ahead. If you already feel comfortable. Now, chapter number 10. Oops, wrong one. Wrong one. Assignment.
Worksheet
okay.
Two, right?
No, this is the assignment sheet. But bring out worksheet 2. Okay, in the assignment sheet, the problems 7 and 8 are the problems where you have to use the two tables. The present value tables. The one for the interest income, the one on the right for interest income, the one on the left for the principal repayment. And so you've done those two, and then all of a sudden you hit this one. And this one is one of the ones that it's a curveball. It will not be on the exam, by the way. And so I like to throw these at you every once in a while to make you think. And so it is essentially the same as problems 7 and 8. Because it's a 10-year bond yielding 5%. Using annual compounding, which means you're going to use the present value table, or a spreadsheet if you have it, what would you predict the price would be for the bond? So now, the hint is, what is different about a zero coupon bond? Zero coupon bonds, no interest. They pay no interest. So we're going to use the exact same formula we did, and so why don't we do problem number 8, for example, here, which is the same as worksheet number 3, worksheet number 2, problem number 3, right?
Do you have any extra ones?
Worksheet number 2, I'm sure I do. This is chapter 10. I thought I did. Can you take a joke? No, I don't. I guess I gave them all away. I gave all the worksheets away. If you come to my office, I'll give you one. Well, let's do, what?
I need one extra as well.
Of worksheet number two. Worksheet number one. Come to my office after work because I'm out of them.
Okay.
Okay. Do you have the bond valuation formula sheets? Okay. Okay, and here's the assignment sheet. So let's do, instead of doing worksheet number, let's do this. Give that to him. And Will, do you have one of these? This is the homework sheet. That's the one we're looking at right now. Pass that back. Okay. So let's do number 8 together. Oh, poopy. I thought I had some formula sheets. I'm out of them. I've given them all away. My apologies. All right. So number 8 says, using annual compounding, what would you predict the price for a 10-year 6% bond, price to yield 9%? Now, this is where people get confused. It's a 10-year bond, and the nominal yield is 6%. So what is the bond paying us? 6% of $1,000 is $60. Don't put 6 cents or you get a sopapo, okay? So if it's a 6% bond, it's paying $60. If it's an 8% bond, it's paying $80. All right? Now here's the tricky part. It's priced to yield 9%. If interest rates have gone up, what happens to bond prices? So we should expect a premium or a discount bond? We should expect a discounted bond. We'll see after we do our calculation. So the value of the bond is equal to the present value of the interest income plus the present value of the principal repayment. Does this look familiar? You all did these over the vacation, right? I know you did. Okay. So that's what you're looking for? You need the tables. What's the interest income for a 6% bond? Everyone should say $60. We have to wait till I ask you. What's the interest, his annual interest on a 6% bond?
$60.
And how do we take the present value of that future income? Well, we use the table that is on the right-hand side. Why? Because that table says the present value of a dollar stream of payments. And we're going to get this $60 for how many years? So we go across to 6% or 9%. This is where people goof up. You got to go over to 9% because it's priced to yield 9%. So this is the one where it gets a little tricky. This is the interest rate you use. This one is how much it originally paid and still pays. Okay. Gerardo, would you hit the light? Sorry. Remember, everything on this campus...
Oh, wow.
Everything on this campus is low bid. We have really great climate control. Have you noticed that? It's either Arctic tundra or it's Saharan desert. There's nothing in between. We have really two good climates, but you know, nothing in between. Same thing is true here. It's either interrogation lights or you can't see anything. So go across to which one? 6 or 9%? 9%. Go down 10 years. What's the present value multiplier? 6.418. Everybody see that? If you don't have it, I apologize. I'm out of them. I've given them all away. If you don't have the tables, I thought I had extras. I'll have to make some extras. Okay, now, we're going to add to that the present value of the principal repayment. Well, how much is the principal repayment? It's always
$1,000.
And now this is a single payment. We don't get the principal every year. We get it once at the end of the term of the bond. So we use the table on the left. So go across to 9% again, down 10 years, and what's the 0.422? So some of you could do that in your head. 1,000 times 0.422 is 422, and then 60 times 6.418. Come on, I'm saying loud, you guys, good calculator. 385.08. If you add those two together, this bond should be priced approximately at 807.08. So is it a discount bond? Yes, that helps us feel that our answer is correct. Now, those are going to be on the exam, folks. Make sure you can do those. Now, number 9, look at number 9. Number 9 is a zero coupon bond priced to yield 5%. Using annual compounding, what would you predict the price would be for the bond? Well, we're going to use the same formula. But what did we say about a zero coupon bond? How much interest does it pay?
Zero.
So the first part is zero. Now, what's it going to pay us at the end of the 20 years? 10 years. What's it going to pay at the end of 10 years? It's going to pay us $1,000. And which table do we use? One on the left, one on the right, one on the left. It's a single payment, so you use the left
lump sum.
Go across to 5% down to 10 years. 0.614, so 0 plus 614, the bond should be selling for 614. Made you think, didn't it?
Well, after you said that, yeah, I mean, I don't know why I
threw
it.
That's okay, it's okay. I threw those in, just, if you don't get those, I'll take it again. If all 8 were great, the first 8 you did fabulously, and didn't do 9 and 10 or fumbled around, I'd still give you 10 points. But I'd ask, what's different about a zero coupon bond? Okay, let's do another one. Let's do number 6. Because this may or may not be on the exam. What did I do? All right, a California investor is in what bracket? 35% federal bracket. So that means they're making, you know, like $200,000. And in the 9% California bracket, they're looking at muni bonds. And, oh, it's just one person. He has a choice of a 5% Ohio bond and a 4.5% California bond. Right, because this gentleman lives in California, he doesn't get taxed the federal tax on either of these because they're muni bonds. But the California is double tax free, double tax exempt. California waives the interest income tax on bonds that are based in California. So which formula do we use for the Ohio bond? Federal only. Which one do we use for the California bond? No, wait, that's the corporate bond. Someone said nothing. Right. The California bond uses the federal and state. And then there's also looking at a 7.5% corporate bond. Which formula do you use for the corporate bond? Don't use a formula or you get a stefople. So no formula for that. But now, who's got the put in the... I do have some of these extras. Formula sheets? Pass those back. Got some extras of these. I'll have to make more. Okay, so we don't have to do anything with the corporate bond. That is 7.5%. Now, I remember the formula. What's the formula? You take the muni bond yield and divide it by 1 minus the federal rate, federal marginal bracket. So 5%. 5%, what do I write? 0.05. 1 minus 0.35. 0.05 divided by 0.65. I can't do that in my head. 0.0769. Keep going. 2, 3. Okay. When you give bond yields, you should at least, folks, use 3. I mean, 2 is okay, but 3 is better. 3 significant digits. So let's say 7.69%. If you leave the answer like that, great. But if you do round correctly, please, you're gonna make us really look bad when you go out in the industry. You know how to round. You went to Southwestern. You know how to round numbers. Okay, you got it? So right off the bat, we know that the Ohio is better than the corporate bond. Now, the California bond, that's a little trickier. 4.5% divided by 1 minus, this looks scary. The federal plus the state times 1 minus the federal. And why does it look so scary?
Well, big parentheses.
So many parentheses. Oh, you just start from the inside out. But the reason is because this term right here, in the 121 class, you might remember, we didn't add this term. But in this class, we added because it's more realistic. Most people who are in this tax bracket are itemizing Schedule A. They're using Schedule A on their tax returns. And so you need to add that to show a true rate of return for them. So we start from the inside out. 1 minus 0.35 is 0.65. 0.09 times 0.65? 0.05585. And then we add that to the 35 here. You going too fast? Maria says
0.4.
No, 2, isn't it? 0.85. Okay. And then don't forget the minus 1 out here. 0.5915. This becomes 0.045 divided by 0.5915. Well, what's that? What is that? 4.5% is 4.5%, which is 0.045. So we found out that this whole mess is this guy right here. Take that divided by that.
0.7.
So, and so where should this round to? Right, 0.761%. And so the Ohio bond is actually a better deal. Make sense? Okay, good. And that may be on the exam. Okay, now. And now let's do number 1 and number 2. I'm going to erase this guy right here. Is that okay?
Yep.
Or do you want me to say the other one? Let's erase this one. Okay. Okay. So now let's take a look at an 8% 20-year bond that the market price is 1125. So we want to know what the current yield is and the yield to maturity. So the current yield is equal to the annual interest Thank you. Divided by the market price. This board is looking pretty bad. They got to come in here with that solvent. Okay, so you take the annual interest on an 8% bond. What's the annual interest?
$80.
Divided. And this is going to I'm going to change the purple. My fault. What's the market price?
No.
What's the market price?
The bottle.
Yeah, 1125. So 80 divided by 1125. 0.0711. More ones. Okay, 7.11%. Now, the yield to maturity is scary. Oh, no, it's not. It's the same formula, except we've got some extra terms. We take the annual interest, and we divide it by the average of the face value, the par value, plus the market value. So how do you take the average? You add the two and divide. You add the two numbers and divide by two. That's all that's doing right there.
Average and mean.
Yeah. It's the mean average. That's the real name. So we say the word average, but there are different types of averages. It's the mean average. You add up the two numbers and divide by two. And then over here, we take the par value, the face value, and we subtract the market price, the market value. And then we divide by the number of years until it matures. All right, so let's do it. What's the annual interest on an 8% bond?
$80.
What's the par value? $1,000. What's the market value? $1,125. And we divide that by 2. And then the par value is $1,000 minus the market value. I'm sorry? Years to maturity. It's 20-year bond, right? Yeah. This one, wait till we get to number two before we do yield to call. We're on the bottom here. Here's the top. Here's the years to maturity. This one is just taking the average of the two. The reason I did that is because I'm trying to follow this so that there's some continuity. If it doesn't work for you, then I apologize. But I like to do the annual interest divided by the average, because then that's similar to the current yield calculation, and then add the bad boy that drives everybody nuts. But some people say, well, why don't you just do the numerator first and then do the denominator? My apologies. Go right ahead. Okay, so 1,000 plus 1,125 divided by 2, 2,125 divided by 2. What is that? 2,125 divided by 2 is 1,062.50. Is that right? Okay, good. Now, what's 1,000 minus 1,125? 125 divided by 20? -6.25. So that means every year we're losing $6.25 of value as this premium bond makes its way back to 1,000. That's all that term is saying, folks. Every year we're losing $6, theoretically.
Well, you already added it on our...
I'm sorry? I haven't added the 80 yet. Right. And now I'm going to add the 80 to a minus $6.25, and you get 73.75 divided by 1062.50. And what's the return? The yield? 0.06941, so 6.94%, which is lower than our current yield, which makes sense because we had to pay $1,125 to get this 7.11%. But when the bond matures, we're only going to get $1,000 back. Okay, good. Now, the yield to call is the exact same formula, except what we do is we... Exactly. We change the par value to the call price, and we change the number of years to maturity. Yes. Well, I think so. I think these calculations are going to be on the exam. No, they're going to be on the bond calculations. Yes, you need to know these. And these are the calculations. I haven't taken the Series 7 in, 15 years and a half? But, yeah, but my understanding hasn't changed that much. Yeah, that's why you're going to get the books in the library or buy one of the books, and at the back of the books they have all these sample exams.
Is there certain editions too, or is it all the same?
Well, there are certain editions of the book. You want to get the latest one. But there are several books, several materials. You study the material. It's exactly the same material in this class. Except they add a lot of crap that you really don't want to detail. You have to know it. And then you take the sample exams over and over and over again. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you got it. No. If it's software, yeah. The software program is going to ask it over and over and over again. But I didn't use the software program. I just used the book. And you don't write in the book. You write the answers on a separate sheet of paper, and you keep taking the sample exams over and over and over again. That's how I passed it. Plus flashcards. It took 2 months of studying 1 to 2 hours a day.
How long is your series?
As long as you, every 2-3 years, do the continuing education, it's good for life. Yeah, and then the continuing education. Yeah, but they're easy. They're really easy. Yeah, it's like going for a urine test or something like that. Unless you're stoned or drunk or whatever, you're going to pass it. Okay. So just make sure you are. No, I think the CPA and the lawyer are harder.
No, but you just take it once.
Right. Once you pass the exam, you're in. You just have to keep taking the continuing education. It's a test, but what they do is they show you the material, and then they ask you the question, and if you get it wrong, they come back and say, "Hey, dummy, look what I just showed you," and then they ask you again, and you have like 4 hours to pass it, and if you don't pass it in 4 hours, you're drunk, or you're stoned, or whatever. So it usually takes you a couple hours to finish it. So you're in. Once you're in. I think the CPA and the lawyer stuff is harder. Certainly those exams are harder, but the continuing education stuff I think is harder. I don't know, though. I don't know. Answer your question? Okay. Yeah, CPA is pretty tough. No, you know which one's even harder? The Chartered Financial Analyst. The CHFA. That's 3 years. It takes you 3 years to pass the exam, and if you don't pass, well, you have to take three of them. You take one every year, and if you screw up, you got to wait another year to take it again.
Oh, God.
Can you? Yeah. Anyway, let's continue. Okay, so the yield to call. Yield to call. Okay, so we changed the par value to the call price, and we change the number of years of maturity to the number of years to call. So it's going to be basically the same thing.
So you use the same information from problem one?
Yeah. You use some of the information from problem one, and then we've introduced the fact that it's callable at 5 years and 1,050. So what's the annual interest? It's still $80. Instead of the par value, we use the $10.50, the call price, plus the market price, divided, $11.25, divided by 2. And then up here, we take the call price minus the market price, divided by how many years? 5 years until call. Okay. And then, so $10.50 plus $11.25 is $2,175 divided by 2? So what is that? 1087.50. Now, $10.50 minus 1112 is minus 75?
Yes.
Divided by 5 is?
Negative.
Minus 15. 80 plus a minus 15? 5.98%. And because we don't get, we only get 5 years to take advantage of the oversized interest payment, it's even lower than the yield to maturity. Cool. We got through. So these problems, these three types of problems, will be on the exam. Plus the constant perpetual, plus the discounted cash flows. Come to my office if you need worksheet number 2. Okay. All right. Cool. Well done. All right. Turn this.